Gentlemen, welcome back to the Daily Friend Show. We return to you at the turning of a tide of some sort. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing, sir?
I must say, Nick, I've done better. I just want to say a brief thing that yesterday the liberal community in South Africa lost a young lion, someone who could have been truly great, a guy by the name of Jacques Jonker. He was with the Free Market Foundation. Then he was a parliamentary researcher for the DEA. And it's tough. He was 25 years old. He was younger than all of us here. And he was a real smart guy, a real decent man. And I just thought, it's not good. It's a tough sell. And I think perhaps it's apt to say that if you at home are struggling with something like depression and you are in extreme circumstances, please get help. Please speak up. It's not the cowardly thing to do. It is the brave thing to do, I think. I'm a bit sad. We keep the fight going. Jacques did a lot of good work, and it's worth putting, that work into action further and keep on doing what we're doing. I think it's good work, but it is a bit of a sad time. Sorry for being a downer out of the gate, but it's an important thing for me.
It's completely appropriate. I don't remember him very well. I think I may have met him, but everyone who's worked with him said that he was a great guy. And I think you say exactly right. He will be sorely missed. We're of course also joined by Mr. Gabriel Krauser.
Gabriel, greetings. Yeah, here we are.
So Herman's connection is a little bit dodgy because he is, of course, in the Northwest. I saw someone in the comments questioning where he was. But anyway, let us get into the news stories of today. And the first one is, yet another day in the Wild West that we call South Africa. And that is that some Eskom employees were taken hostage by the community of Marula View, Mabopane, in the north of Tswane, because the local community demanded that they replace the local substation. There was a standoff with law enforcement agencies, and eventually the Eskom employees were released, and the city issued Eskom issued a thing saying that such criminal acts are condemned. But the reason we bring this up is not particularly because this story is super exciting or super novel. It's that it's pretty common, actually. I remember when I was a ward councillor talking to city power officials in Johannesburg, and this is a fairly common thing, that they were often absolutely terrified of the communities they were supposed to serve. And if they saw crowds forming, they would often just leave in the middle of repair jobs because they were worried about being attacked. This is common pretty much everywhere in South Africa, but particularly I think our big metros and places with recurring power outages. One of the big problems that seems to have caused this incident here is a lot of the poorer suburbs in South Africa, they often border shack settlements, and the shack settlements are well known for stealing electricity from the mains. They'll just go and dig up like a big power cable and they'll basically plug into it. And that, of course, causes power problems and power outages and damaged infrastructure for the people who pay for the electricity nearby. And this leads to tension with the city officials for not managing to control it. It leads to tensions with the shack settlements. I've heard of incidents of violence between people living in the sort of formal housing and shack settlements over this kind of thing. So yeah, it's a real big problem, and it does speak to some sort of larger issues, I think, about how the relationship between communities and government has gone in South Africa. Gabriel, your thoughts on this issue?
Yeah, I think it's interesting in part because we often see the dissolution of society. Nick and I like to have sort of a bit of a running joke about, like, is South Africa really a country? There are so many incidents that make you wonder whether the sort of thing you see on a map really describes a sovereign state, or if it's a kind of geographical terrain upon which is laid a quilt of a multitude of societies that don't really fit together. because the rule of law is undermined. But in as much as people end up doing things for themselves, whether it's security, water, electricity, the kind of hyper-individualistic do-it-yourself thing is great, people also find that they have to work together. So when the state is not doing its job, there's a dissolution where the community becomes like grains of sand, but then those grains of sand quickly lump together again voluntarily to form a kind of brick. So from like a political science point of view, one of the timeless questions for the last 400 years is like, what does it look like to go from what's often referred to as the state of nature, where every individual is for him or herself, into a society? And there's lots of different theories, but I feel like in South Africa, you see it play out again and again, because people are trying to form a society. They're trying to say, look, we're desperate. We have no electricity. We need to plug in. Or they're trying to say, look, you guys are stealing our stuff. You need to go away. Or they're trying to say, someone else is stealing the stuff and you guys aren't replacing it quickly enough. So this time we're going to hold you hostage to make sure that next time, as city power guys or as government representatives, you come quicker and do your jobs properly. All of these are collective actions, are desperate attempts to form a society that dissolves almost as quickly as it's formed. I think for lack of a through line in purpose, and I think that this is a relentless battle. It's an interesting battle to see play out. I've seen the opposite. I've seen this both in business, where people get held hostage in KZN and Limpopo by union workers who are demanding to get their jobs back or something like that. And of course, there was a famous case recently on the coast where someone was killed in such a dispute at a large factory, large manufacturer. But I think there's something, I don't know. It's an interesting case where one really feels the heartstrings of sympathy pull for these people trying to make sure their power gets reticulated properly and that the substation is as it ought to be. At the same time, I don't think that they've got the right solution. And I think that the right solution is just old-fashioned, and it's simple, and it's the basic kind of limited government that's also responsible program that the IRR has been offering for a long time.
Evan, your thoughts on, just the situation, how we got to the stage where, in some cases, people seem to be at war with their own local government.
Yeah, no, I think two things stand out for me. Is number one is I think Gabriel makes a very important point that people often misunderstand about classic liberals and individualists. I'm an individualist, classic liberal, but that doesn't mean I consider myself to be a hermit or an island. It's just that I want for myself, as an individual, the freedom to choose the groups I belong to. So if you're in favor of an individualistic liberal society, you're not saying groups are evil and all forms of groups are, the manifestation of disaster. It is just that you leave it to the citizen, you leave it to the individual to decide the groups that they wish to associate with. So I do think it's a very important point to realize that liberalism acknowledges and builds upon these ad hoc, organic, pragmatic, practical formations of groups joining together for a communal good and then dispersing and then joining together or not dispersing like a church. But the point is that I think that this is a very important illustration where there is this natural inclination of people to face some problems collectively and some individually. And I mean, that's as discouraging as this whole thing is, that shouldn't be completely discouraging to liberals, because it shows that organically organized collectives can get things done. We can discuss the merits of those things, but we should be encouraged by the fact that a community is, even after a century of being, just decimated in terms of the social fabric, still in some way able to find organic coordination. And that's something to build on and then, to nurture into something healthy. And how do we do that? Well, I think here One of the great failings of South Africa's young democracy is knowledge and education. I remember working for the DA's election campaign in 2019, and I read this story about an ANC councillor who told his constituents that they did not get service delivery because the IEC, the Electoral Commission, had not designated that ward to be the recipient of service delivery. And then the constituents went and burnt down the local IEC office. So the reason the politician could get off the hook there is just the citizen wasn't informed and wasn't quite educated and bought into how democracy and how the specific type of democracy works. And I think that's also the tragedy here, is these poor bloody Eskom workers. They are not the problem. It really is a matter where you have this disconnect between the voter and the politician, and in between you've got, you know, whatever manifestation of the civil service there is, and they get the brunt, and the politician is very often, if they choose to be, isolated from any of the consequences. So I do think a way to build on this and to get from this, you know, seed-like organic collectivist instinct for problem solving is to go to a point where we say, right, how does this actually work? How does governance work? And I think opposition parties especially have failed in this regard to properly explain how the system can be altered if you change the political element and you accept that the civil service element is accountable to the political element. So I do think there's a massive knowledge deficit in South Africa in a civics way that should be addressed.
Right. I think that really kind of, yeah, what you guys have said sort of captures one of the big problems, I think, in South Africa, which is this misdirected energy. It's not that people don't have energy and ingenuity and cunning intelligence, all these good things. It's that they spend it badly. You know, they're taking Eskom employees hostages instead of voting in a councillor or a government or whatever that would solve the problem better. Or they're burning down a school instead of doing something different. Or you get the point.
Yeah. And I think, Nick, that's why we see the inverse correlation between, you know, voter participation on the decline and service delivery protest on the rise, because people aren't blind to the challenges they face. They have just lost faith in, you know, your established political thing. So if you want to prevent this, invest.
Right. The solution is encouraging people to go and use the proper channels to express their frustration. I see someone is saying that your picture is a bit blurry, Herman. That is because you are indeed in the Northwest, struggling to get internet, I believe is the situation, or running off of an old laptop. My apologies for that. Anyway, all right. Any final thoughts, Gabriel, before we move on to our next topic?
No, this feels like too good a segue for the next topic. I mean, listen, people, this is the week to register to vote in the local government elections. That closes on Sunday, Saturday and Sunday. You should do it. Whoever you want to vote for, register to vote. I have never voted in a local government election myself. I am going to be voting in my first local government election, my first municipal election. I'm stoked. I say that because a lot of people feel like if they haven't done it before, it's too late to start. Or if they did it and they stopped, it's too late to go back. It's okay. You missed a round. Get back in the fight. That's my segue. I'm just going to underline it. Is that obvious?
That's very good. That's very good. Also, I didn't realize, Gabriel, that you were part of the problem until so recently.
I was. And then I kind of, I don't know. I figured it out. I think that there's a nasty kind of essentialism, cultural, all kinds of. There's a thought that people can't change. And there's some things about character that do persist. There'll always be some quirks to my own character, but one does grow up a little bit, and sometimes it happens slowly, and sometimes it happens quickly. But things do change, and that's been a change for me. Now I'd like to make an announcement of a change for the IRR to segue properly into our next section, which I've just received confirmation as the show was starting that we are going back to the Constitutional Court. Project Save the Vote is still fighting for your right, for everyone's right, to participate in a credible and regular election, free and fair, safe, and when it's supposed to be. This has been a huge and long nightmare for people to believe in constitutional democracy. We've won so far.
That Gabriel has gone from being part of the problem to being our foremost warrior in the trenches to save democracy. This is a light-speed transition.
I have never voted in a local government election. I want to vote so much that we're going to court to make sure we can vote. I really want to vote because I think it matters.
So what are the developments in the case? So, of course, you're going back to the Constitutional Court to oppose the reopening of the candidate lists. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. So as everyone knows, the ANC couldn't register in time all of its candidates. So it's got candidates in most municipalities, but there's a significant minority where it messed up. And then it said, this is prejudice. This wasn't our fault. This is the IEC. The internet was like Herman's is right now. And that's what stopped us from getting through. But it was nice for the other people. It was discriminating, helping Gabriel, harming Herman. This was basically their argument. Then the IEC said, no, that's no good. And then the AEC said, no, we'll take it back. It was actually all our fault. And then conveniently, the IEC said, okay, it was all your fault. We're going to reopen the election. Reopen the candidate list so that you can have your candidates everywhere. Never mind the fact that you missed the deadline that other parties managed to reach through backbreaking work. And we'll ignore the fact that you missed it because you weren't paying your own staff and you've admitted it was your own competence. We're going to reopen the whole process so that it's okay for everyone, but really so that it's much better than for you, or at least it will certainly be much better for you. You'll get a great advantage out of this. Everyone else is going to lose out. They've already started working on the basis of where they were, having met the deadline. But we're going to do that. We're going to do that basically because we think, on my interpretation of what the IEC said, the development is the IEC has now explained itself. The situation has created a great confusion. Is the IEC just helping the ANC out? Or can it really reopen the candidate list? And the Concord said that by Monday, the IEC must explain itself. And the ANC, by the way, must also explain itself because it's joined this thing. So now we've seen what the IEC has to say for itself. We've seen what the ANC has to say for itself. And today, what's just come out in the last half an hour is we've seen how the DA has responded to that. So just a super view is the DA is opposed to reopening the list. The IFP is opposed to opening the list. The EFF is opposed to opening the list. Those are the main political parties that are opposed. The ANC is for it and the IEC is for it. This is not voter registration. Voter registration is going forward. You must register. This is the list for candidates. Now, basically what the IEC seems to be saying is that in any election, it's got this power in section 11.2 of the Municipal Electoral Act, if you want to look it up. In any election, after a deadline, like a candidate nomination deadline, it can undo the deadline, take a match, set the deadline on fire, make a new deadline. So it's claiming that it's always got this power to do it, and that if the court says it doesn't have this power, then the court is overstepping the separation of powers. So that's ridiculous. The court's already found in previous cases with the IFP and the NFP, for example, asking for the deadline to be undone after the fact. The court said you can't do this. You ruin the freeness and fairness of an election if you burn a deadline and then put in a new one after the fact. So before the fact, before the deadline, the IEC can move it at its own discretion. Oh, it's coming Sunday. We can make it Wednesday. But after the fact, they can't change their mind on the precedent. The second bit of their argument is they say, well, even if we don't always have this power, we've got this power this time because the Constitutional Court gave us this power. Why? Because the Constitutional Court said you must reopen the voter registration. That's what's happening this weekend. And usually it's voter registration, then it's candidate nomination. Like usually it's dinner, then it's ice cream. So in this case, it must also be dinner, then ice cream. Okay, but we've already had the ice cream. We've already had the candidate nominations. But now we're having dinner. Now we get to have ice cream again. That's their argument. The court has allowed us to reopen the candidate nominations because it has reopened the voter registration. Now, that argument doesn't work, to my mind, because that's not what the court's order says. the court's order specifically says someone asked us to reopen the candidate nominations. That someone was the EFF. And the court's order specifically says you can't do that. Now, I'm going to say one last thing, and if you're with me so far, then you are deep in the legal woods. But the IEC's come back to that is they say, no, no, no. The EFF asked for two things. They wanted you to reopen the – they wanted you to unban political gatherings over 100 people. And they said, and if you let us do that, then we also want you to reopen the candidate nominations because that way we can have big rallies and big meetings to figure out who our candidates should be. So the court said no to each. So then the IEC is saying – the court was only thinking about this situation where you want to reopen candidate nominations because you've unbanned political gatherings. It wasn't saying in general that you can't reopen the candidate list. So that's kind of where the IEC is sitting. Now, the DA has made some of its counter arguments, and some of them are good, some of them not so good. This is why we're going to have to get involved. We're going to have to improve on all of the counter arguments that have been brought by all of the political parties. But the technical detail there is that the EFF itself said our call to reopen the candidate list is only relevant if you give us the unbanning of the political rallies. So if the court just wanted to say it's up to the IEC to decide, we're giving it the superpower, it can decide one way or another to reopen. Usually it couldn't reopen the candidate list, but this time it can reopen the candidate list because we are cancelling the voter registration and we don't want to prejudice it one way or another in terms of what it does. Then it only would have said to the EFF's appeal, we cancel that section that says you want to unban political rallies, because that automatically would have cancelled all of the EFF's appeal. Instead, they said separately, we also want to cancel that part of the EFF's appeal to reopen the candidate list. So that seems clear that the court was going out of its way to say, we're not giving you the superpower. Ordinarily, you can't burn a deadline after the fact. And in this case, just in case you think maybe you can burn a deadline after the fact, we're going to make it clear that you can't by separately dismissing the EFF's appeal to reopen the candidate list. So that's the legalese. The headline story is that the IEC said we can't do this. We can never reopen the candidate list and get the election done on time. They said that 2 weeks ago. Now they're saying, no, we can do it. Don't worry about it. We can do it. So either they lied to the court, or they were telling the truth then and they're lying now, or they have no idea what they're doing. But either which way, they're setting up a lot of confusion. And they, I think, setting up a situation where after the fact, some people are going to try and challenge these elections. And that's partly why it's so important for people to get out and get registered and go and vote, because the greater the participation is, the harder it will be to challenge these elections hereafter. I think one of the concerning things is that all of this confusion about the court process, is the ANC going to get its ballots, is it not, is sort of taking energy away from what really should be the focus this week, which is for South Africans that are frustrated with their circumstances, regular voters or occasional voters or non-local government voters like me, to get involved, get registered, and go and do the thing. Because the more of that there is, the less all of this technicality matters. We're trying to fight the technical side. But really, if millions of South Africans go ahead and do the right thing, they'll pick the ball up from our hands and take it over the try line.
Yeah, so I just want to say that if you do want to go register, there'll be the registration weekend, but there's also, you can do it on the IEC website. I tried that method out just to see how well it worked, and it worked pretty well for me. I needed to change my registration because I've moved. Herman, any additional thoughts before we move on to our final topic?
Yeah, perhaps we could just address some of the snark coming through the comment section. Whiskey Jack ZA is throwing some shade there. That's just a shade without a tree. Firstly, of course, you argue in your favor in a court case. I mean, that's obvious. But you don't lie. You don't go from the one pleading the 1 week saying that to my lords, my ladies, it is impossible to open this candidate list again. It is impossible to do all that we need to. And then a week later, after you've gotten a judgment that is antagonistic to your position, then suddenly change the reality of your capacity to say, oh, well, now we can do anything. I mean, a week ago, we couldn't do this, but today, oh, I mean, sky's the limit. So I just think to try and see that as the IEC arguing its own case is just terribly naive. It's just plain up lying. And the other thing is that the IEC from the start have been saying the same thing up until the Constitutional Court held that the election must take place. They said, the IEC being they, that they do not have the time, the capacity, or the resources to reopen candidate lists. They said it in as many words. And if you think that they've been consistent on this, I think you've been misreading their heads of argument or their legal papers significantly. And on the issue that there isn't a full judgment, of course there isn't a full judgment because it was an application. And an application is answered by a court order, not by a court judgment. So, of course, there isn't a full judgment here. But then you do as Gabriel does and as the IR's legal team does, is you look at what the court held and what they didn't hold and what they expressly did not hold. And the prayer and the relief sought by the EFF to reopen candidate lists was expressly dismissed, uniquely, almost singled out by the court in its judgment. So yes, we don't have clarity on the position. That is why we don't have full clarity on the position. That is why the court process is so important. But to quibble about the fact that the IEC has been consistent is just simply to equate dishonesty with consistency.
All right, let us move on to our final topic. And I know Gabriel was very excited to talk about this one. And this is the battle over the pavement to defend a cabbage patch. So in a suburb in Pretoria, a guy called Joe Bankuna turned a piece of his the sidewalk, you know, where people often plant like flowers and things. He started growing cabbages there. And there's a park across the road from him, which was very overgrown. He claims, according to a Facebook post, that the grass was a meter high. And so he also planted some vegetables there. And he gives those to his wife, who's a social worker, to distribute to the communities in which she works. Well, someone issued a complaint to the Tshwane Metro Police Department saying that he was inappropriately using the road reserve. And some officers from the TMPD showed up to have a conversation with him and said that he needed to get rid of his cabbage garden. Now, according to him, they threatened to arrest him if indeed he did not get proper planning approval because he was in violation of the bylaws. He claims that he went to the local government offices, asked them for planning permission, and they laughed at him and told him that he needed no such thing and that he was being a fool and that he should just get out. He then went to argue with the TMPD in their offices, and apparently, according to him, once again, the station commander, a man called Elvis Ndlovu, threatened to arrest him because he doesn't care what the bylaws say. He doesn't want cabbages on his road reserves. So we don't really know all of the details here because, you know, so far all we've got is a few very vague comments from city officials and the Facebook post describing this incident. But Gabriel, your thoughts on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, this thing has just been blowing up on Facebook, and there are a couple of news articles that have come out where reporters have tried to get on the ground and find more facts. It looks like that he is harvesting his cabbages and onions now for a final time, and he won't be planting again until this matter is resolved. I think it's adorable. I think part of it is like just the way that he writes about how he used to have beetroot and spinach and pumpkins, and that wasn't a problem. But now it's cabbages and it's become a very big problem. It's like there's almost a subtle kind of South African irony. Like he's like, his allegation in essence is that there's a discrimination. There's a kind of, there's an anti-cabbage discrimination playing out in Pretoria.
He also referred to himself as the cabbage bandit.
He said they're going to come and get the cabbage bandit. And I think it's just, this is, this is the city that the union buildings are in. And it just reminded me of like how mad that garden is, where there's marijuana plants in the union buildings and squatters. And there's something about gardening. It's so where like man meets soil, where human meets soil. It's right at the interface between civilization and nature. And that seems to be where so many of our battles are. And it's a sweet, I think, instantiation of the chaos. And I hope that this thing works out nicely and that everyone has a good dinner.
Yeah. This is also a DA-run city. So the DA is not above causing municipal messes that are kind of embarrassing like this. One really feels like there should be an easy solution here, and police shouldn't be threatening to arrest people for a bylaw violation as simple as using the road reserve wrong. Herman, in 30 seconds, your thoughts.
Very briefly. I think it was Gladstone who said that the purpose of the law is to make easy that which is just and to make difficult that which is unjust. And I just think this fails that test so obviously. It is, of course, just to feed poor people. I just think it is just such a discombobulation of the law in its stupidest ass-like form that it is here standing in the way of doing an obviously objectively just thing. And then the second thing, just a rule of law point. One of the 8 components of the rule of law is that the law should be accessible, that your everyday person should be able to know what the law is and to understand it and to apply it to their own lives. Last year with COVID regulations, Dr. Anthea Jeffrey and I spent hours looking at study regulations coming from the COGTA department. And if I couldn't understand a law, that's one thing. I mean, that's just my shortcomings showing themselves ungraciously. But if Dr. Anthea Jeffrey can't understand a law, I mean, there's something massively wrong. And if you go to a police station and you ask just to see the law that you are violating and they can't do that, I mean, that's embarrassing. That is embarrassing, and the state, that's bad, and the state should feel bad.
It should.
Indeed. And I think, and I speak under correction, but I think I remember the rules for road reserves are, as long as you leave a pathway for pedestrian foot traffic, you're allowed to kind of keep the thing as you want.
And who respects that?
Yeah, exactly.
This is just cabbage discrimination. Crazily
selectively enforced. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Thanks, everyone. Cheers.